Welcome to Lickin' On Leadership.
The purpose of this program is to bring to you interviews with industry leaders.
A weekly podcast bringing you leaders of the real estate and mortgage industry.
And I can't think of anyone better to join me in this role of providing this co-hosting role than one of the top leaders in our industry, and that's Mark Jones of AmeriFirst Mortgage Banking Group.
And here's the host of Lickin' On Leadership, David Lickin and Mark Jones.
Folks, I'm really fortunate to have Mark Jones joining me as the co-host of the Lickin' On Leadership program. The purpose of this program is to bring to you interviews with industry leaders, and I can't think of anyone better to join me in this role of providing this co-hosting role than one of the top leaders in our industry, and that's Mark Jones of AmeriFirst Mortgage Banking Group. He's the CEO and co-founder of AmeriFirst. Mark, good to have you here.
David, thank you. It's nice to be here, and I'm always so flattered by your introductions. Thank you very much.
I'm honored. We're honoring leaders, and there's no one better to do that with than one of the top leaders. So our listeners are about ready to listen to an interview of David Stevens. You've worked with David. You know him. As our listeners get ready for this interview, I'd like to have you put some commentary on the front side, and then we're going to get your commentary afterwards. What are your thoughts on David Stevens?
Well, you know, it's kind of cool. I've got several different perspectives of Dave because, you know, I've been an MBA member for many, many years, and I also witnessed him when he was at HUD and how he handled some fairly difficult, delicate situations there with Taylor Bean Whitaker and some other things and came down and really took care of some ugliness that was there. Then to see him as leader of MBA and then recently getting more of an insider view because I've been on the board of MBA for just about a year now, and so I've been able to witness him up close and personal at board meetings and other board events, and with every one of those notches of getting to know him better, my respect for him has grown and grown because he is a fantastic leader. The aplomb and the dignity he carries himself with in the way he represents our industry, the access that he has to leaders on Capitol Hill and throughout our industry is unprecedented. You know, I feel very fortunate that we have him at the helm of MBA. And so I can't think of a better leader to start off this series with than someone of Dave's caliber.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Listeners, let's listen to the interview that I conducted with Dave, and we pre-recorded. And by the way, for future interviews, we're going to have Mark involved with me. I just happened to catch up with Dave at a time where Mark wasn't available. So listeners, here's the interview of David Stevens.
Folks, we're excited to have with us David Stevens, the CEO of the Mortgage Bankers Association of America. He is our inaugural guest as we kick off the Lickin' On Leadership podcast. Very excited to have him here, and there's probably no one better that we could have as an industry leader to talk about leadership than David Stevens. He is doing an excellent job and has for some time there at the MBA, Mortgage Bankers Association of America, and we're honored to have you here with us, David. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Good to be with you.
You've brought so much leadership in so many areas. You know, I respect you so much at so many levels, and I look at what you've recently gone through, and it's quite exemplary for our industry. But let's start with where you started in the mortgage industry. What drew you to the industry, and how did you get started in this?
You know, I'd like to say there's some divine history that brought me into the industry, but I'll be honest with you and tell you that I was in a political job, surprise, surprise, having ended up working for the last president, fairly recently out of college in Boulder, Colorado, in Denver, Colorado, which is where I moved to after college. And I honestly needed a career that would make me more money than what I was making there. And it's as simple as that. There was a guy named Brad Blackwell, who was my post-college roommate. We ran against each other for student body president in college. He's now an executive vice president at Wells Fargo Home Mortgage. He was a loan rep for Savings and Loan in Boulder. And he called me and said, you know, you could make, this is a long time ago, David, you could make $30,000 a year as a loan officer. And I thought that was huge money. And so I applied and actually got turned down by the first regional manager. And so a different region in Colorado, the manager called me and hired me on the spot. That's my track into lending. It's by pure accident.
But this industry does afford people a good lifestyle, and it's one that is such a dynamic one. The part that really appealed to me when I first got into it was, I'm chuckling because how I got into it was like your journey. It was looking just for, you know, making some more money. Started at a bank as you did, and it's interesting, we both have the past president, I was the student body president several times. And what's interesting, I got as a write-in. So that was my journey into that. So it's just crazy how that works. But the mortgage industry is something that draws a unique type of individual.
Yeah.
You talked about your roommate who you had roomed with after post-college, and he is now a senior executive at Wells Fargo. Talk about what you think draws people in, or what's the right type of person that should consider a career in mortgage lending.
Well, you know, it is unfortunate in that, you know, I run the mortgage bank because we have commercial lenders and residential lenders. And I find in commercial lending, it really attracts people who major in real estate finance in college and they get into the commercial real estate industry. Residential mortgage lending doesn't have the same traditional pathway. A lot more people sort of fall into that role. In my day, it was, you know, you had to have the ability to have communication skills. You had to have an internal drive that would motivate you without someone looking over your shoulder to get up each morning and go out and call on real estate agents. You have to have a durability. I went through a lot of sales training when I was in that period. I always used to tell people, you've got to really welcome and look for rejection, because if you can get rejected a certain number of times, you're ultimately going to get someone who says yes, but you got to get through all those individual rejections, the no's first, and you have to learn not to take it personally. And it's hard to get started, David, as you know. You have to build relationships with real estate agents. It's what I call a pull-through sale, because you have to pull the home buyer through the realtor. At least it was more so back in my day, and it still is to a large degree. And so I had to have really great relationships with realtors that knew me as someone who was personable, who had attention to detail, who understood my products, who would follow up, and who would keep the customer, the home buyer, in the forefront of my mind to keep them happy all the way through the process. But honestly, if you can do those things, you can get rewarded handsomely. And I think what young people fail to realize in this business is it may be hard starting off, but once you start building a reputation and relationships, which doesn't take long if you work hard and go out and face that rejection every day, you're going to get to the point where you're just answering the phone and you're fulfilling the needs of professional real estate agents and home builders and others who need help. And ultimately, you're getting repeat clients. And you know, I remember when I first started out, a lot of people in the savings and loan industry looked at me as this young, untrained nobody. And within a year, I was number four in my company. And so it is really easy to differentiate yourself in this business as long as you're willing to confront the realities of the initial fact that it is a sales industry. And you've got to have that ability to communicate, to persuade people, and to do the work to build that foundation. If you do it, I honestly believe that there's no better business to be in. I don't know how you feel. I often look back. I've held, as you know, many senior roles in this industry. People always ask me, what was my favorite job? I loved being a loan rep. It was just a great time in my life, a great time to be, you know, learning this business, and it became foundational for what ultimately has been a really great career.
I think that's a great point. You know, it's handing that first set of keys to that first buyer, that really tough transaction, and looking at the joy that radiates out of them, the pride that brings to that. And I think about the stability for families, the stability for the home, the marriages, the kids, and how that just has the potential of elevating their life. And so that is excellent. I agree with you on that point. Home ownership is such a key to our economy and also to our personal lives. You talked about duration. When you look at your duration in this industry, you've been at it for how many years now?
Well, I started in 83, over 30 years. And I'm not counting anymore.
Yeah, I started in 73, so I got a 10-year jump on it. But, you know, I have never looked back or regretted this. There's been difficult times in it. It has been difficult.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your journey to where you're at today. You got that first loan origination job. You accelerated quickly within 1 year to become number four within the organization. Take us from then to now.
Well, let me try to do it relatively high speed, but I'll stop at a couple points. Like a lot of companies do, they oftentimes promote the top salespeople into management roles. And so I took over the Denver office as a manager with no training on how to manage. Honestly, I made a whole ton of mistakes as a young manager, but fortunately I had a mentor in my life, who was my boss, and he taught me how to manage. He taught me something called situational leadership to help identify which of my salespeople needed the most attention and direction. And then we used something called the management process, which was a way of learning how to give constructive feedback and help develop personnel on the way. But when I first walked in the job, I fired everybody because they weren't like me. They weren't outgoing. They didn't have my profile. I thought I needed to hire my own image, mistake number one, in a big way. But learned how to become a good manager, and the branch suddenly lit on fire. We became one of the top producing branches in the country. At the time, the savings and loan industry in the early 80s, it was after the savings and loan crisis and FIREA, and terms that a lot of people may know or not know depending on their age. But we were buying savings and loans across the country, and we started buying savings and loans on the East Coast that had failed. And I was one of the early managers who was asked by the president of the company to move to the East Coast. And I would build branches from scratch, loan operation centers. And we moved to New Jersey and built one there for about 9 months. Became very productive very quickly. They then relocated me to Connecticut. Then they relocated me to Virginia to keep doing it. And it must have been the timing, because it can't be all me, but each one of those branches just literally caught on fire. And just a great pathway of success. And I ended up being relocated to headquarters in California and given a job as national sales support manager, because I thought I had some skills that could be shared with others. It was just a really fun adventure because everything was hitting on all cylinders all the time. And over a 17-year span, became a regional manager and then a division manager running, you know, one of the coasts. I ran the East Coast and then ran the West Coast. We moved 11 times in that 17-year
wow.
period. But it was a fast-growing savings and loan, and made lots of friends and hired a lot of people and got to work with some great talent, and had my mentor in my career who taught me a lot about managing large organizations and building teams and having higher standards for success and having an indelible work ethic and all the things that, you know, you can read in any book about how to be successful. And it all worked. I'll just quickly say, after 17 years, I was going to stay there forever. I got a call from a headhunter asking me if I'd consider interviewing at Freddie Mac. Freddie Mac hired me. I became the senior vice president and head of the single family business at Freddie and stayed almost a decade there. Got recruited away by my biggest customer, Wells Fargo, and became executive vice president, head of all wholesale lending for Wells. This is all pre-recession, of course. A large real estate company in D.C. called Long & Foster. It's one of the largest privately held real estate companies in America with mortgage companies and elsewhere. Recruited me away. It was a great career opportunity with almost no travel, so my wife was happy about that. And I took that job and probably would have retired with Long & Foster. I was president and chief operating officer, so I ran real estate, mortgage, and our title companies and everything associated with the business. But I got a call from the new administration, from President Obama and his team, and asked to come in 2009 to become federal housing commissioner and work on what was being called the housing team that dealt with, you know, TARP and HAMP financing and all the distressed housing issues, and really a lot to do with the GSE, the long-term future of housing finance and more. And it was just too exciting an opportunity to give up, not because it was necessarily President Obama or some other presidents, because of the times
right.
that we were in, and to be in the center of that was really exciting. So I did that. And when I left, after exhaustion hit, I came to the mortgage banker. So there you go. That's the full litany.
There's so much. You didn't think, starting as a loan originator, and that's Boulder, Colorado. Was it in Boulder?
It was in Denver, actually. I graduated from Boulder, but moved to Denver. Yeah.
It was in Denver. Okay. And from Denver, LO, to the White House, advising through one of the most horrific crises our nation has gone through, as at least it relates to the housing finance system. And what an instrumental role you played during that time. I remember you showing me pictures of you sitting there and were explaining to them the basics of just like warehousing.
Yeah.
And the importance of warehouse financing. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's funny because I have a picture on my office wall of me sitting in the Roosevelt Room, which is the president's conference room. It's right across from the Oval Office. And the picture you've seen, obviously, is me with the president and Secretary Geithner from the Treasury Department and Secretary Donovan from HUD and all the rest of the leadership that was working on housing issues. Just quick story. So my first call to come meet the president was 3 weeks literally into the job. And I'm looking at myself thinking, I have a Bachelor of Arts degree in political science from the University of Colorado. I ski really well. And I'm invited to a meeting where everybody has a PhD from Harvard or Yale or somewhere, and they run international finance. So I walk into the Roosevelt Room, to the President's Conference Room, and they have couches around the outer rim of the room and the tables in the middle. And I immediately thought, I'm going to go sit on the couch because I ain't sitting at the table with all these brilliant geniuses. You know, literally, Secretary Geithner comes in. I've come to know him as Tim, and we've become good friends. But at the time, it's Secretary Geithner. I've never met him before. He knows everybody in the room, and he looks at me on the couch. He goes, you're Stevens, right? And I go, yeah. And he goes, sit at the table. So I immediately grabbed that spot on the table, which you've seen in the picture was the corner spot with direct eyesight with the president on the side with Tim and Sean Donovan and others. And the president walks in. He's flanked by David Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel and the team that was his senior staff at the time. He always read everything. He was extremely studied. So he walks in. He goes, okay, I've read all the material. I understand the issues that we're talking about today. I just need to understand what a warehouse line is. And at the time, if you recall, warehouse financing really dried up at the beginning of the recession, and there was a worry there was no liquidity for mortgage bankers. So we were thinking of using TARP money to create a warehouse line. And so table goes silent. And I'm thinking, come on, someone speak. I mean, there's rocket scientists in finance all around this table. Nobody can explain a warehouse line. Tim leans down at me and he goes, Stevens, answer the question. Here I am 3 weeks in the job. I have a degree in partying, basically, from Colorado. I have decades of experience in mortgage finance, and I start explaining a warehouse line and how it works, and I look up, and the President of the United States is staring at me intently in the eyes. And thus began what was really an interesting time, because over the next couple of years, when we were working so diligently on so many issues, they often wouldn't hold meetings on housing finance if I couldn't be there, because subject matter expertise in mortgage finance isn't something you can just read in a book. And everybody here who knows, who's in the business knows, you learn as you go through this business, and you learn a lot. It's knowledge you gain over time. It's hard to be an expert in everything. And the White House team, at least at the time, no matter what you think about them, when it comes to housing finance, at least they knew what they didn't know. And, you know, I became the mortgage guy in the administration and met with the president and his team frequently on these subjects.
For such a time as that, and I was so grateful to have you with your knowledge there, but it is, I mean, I relate to you. I'm a snow skier. I lived in Aspen. I got there because I flunked out of college because I was having too much fun. Went back and finished college, did well, got a degree, and went into mortgage finance. So I relate to so many parts of your story. But I think what's so encouraging about it, David, is someone who does not have the Harvard MBA, PhD background can have such an impact. And I don't think there's many industries you can do that in other than a mortgage finance. So I celebrate those and those stories. I'm sure there are so many stories we could get into. A little bit earlier, you mentioned about situational leaders and situational leadership and management systems. If you could expand upon that a little bit, because it sounded like that had a big influence on you. And did you take any of that into the White House with you?
Well, I've taken these management philosophies with me everywhere I've been. My career, the savings loan I worked at, was very training focused. In fact, you had to go through a minimum number of training classes every month. And they really promoted leadership training and management training. We'd compete against each other and design training classes for managers where the classes would vote on which one was best. And if you were the best trainer, you would get trips. My wife and I took a trip to Hawaii once because I won an award. So that kind of culture doesn't exist everywhere. And I'll acknowledge right out that I was fortunate to have that kind of culture. But situational leadership is easy. It takes two basic concepts, commitment and competence. And we always talk about these in advance. But, you know, you have to have both to be successful. So, example, when you have a new employee on the job and they walk into their new role, they're very committed. They're excited for their new role. They're excited to have a new job. But they have no competence. And so situational leadership says you should be highly directive, and you don't need to be as supportive of the individual. You just have to tell them what to do. Give them a calendar. This is what you're going to do in the morning. This is what you're going to do at night. These are the classes you're going to go through. This is who you're mentoring with. And that's how you apply that leadership training. But employees go through cycles, and after they've been on the job for a period of time, they realize, hey, the job's not as great as I thought it was, and they're also not as productive as they can be. So their commitment drops because they're no longer as committed to the role, and their competence still isn't there, so they've got low competence. And so the response is you have to be highly directive and highly supportive of that individual and really much more hands-on and meet with them far more frequently, or you risk churning them over. By the way, that's the biggest failure of sales companies today is they don't recognize what's called situation two, which is that situation. That's the highest volatile period of turnover. And someone can fall in there either as a new employee as they're developing through, or they can fall into it as a high-producing employee, but market situations shift. They're suddenly not as productive as they were. they're not making the money, they blame their employer for not having the products or tools or whatever it is, they can slip back in to situation two, low commitment and low competence because they don't know how to deal in a new market. So if you understand that and you apply the management skill, the leadership skill of get highly directive with them and highly supportive and put them on a far more frequent coaching and counseling process, you can probably retain them and help them become more effective and keep them as long-term employees. Very simple management skill. It took weeks of training to become proficient at it because you have to go through all sorts of scenarios. But I literally have taken that everywhere I go. And people who know me, some will say it's ADHD, which probably isn't far off in certain cases. But people will know if it's an issue or individual that I'm really concerned about, I'm focused on that extraordinarily deliberately and purposefully. But I realize you can't manage everybody the same way. It's a game of whack-a-mole and you'll spread yourself too thin. You've got to focus on the area where the whack-a-mole head's about to pop up. And that's if you spend your time on issues that way and spend your time on personnel, the most important personnel to manage is the one that's at the greatest risk. And you fan and feed your top performers, but, you know, poor salespeople tend to aggregate and flock to their top performers because they just like hanging with them because they're more fun and they're more successful. But good leaders and good managers are the ones who recognize that and recognize that that's an easy out, and they spend their time focused on the ones that need the most development. And if you can do that effectively, you can build a broader, more successful sales force, I think.
As the CEO of the MBA, you see so many companies, and you're seeing some that are doing very, very well. And you see some others that probably almost inexplicably are failing. What are the keys to succeeding in this current market? And has there been a shift, David? I mean, has there been a shift in the factors that causes for one company to be successful than another in the market where we're headed?
Well, look. Yeah, I mean, it would be totally unfair for me to comment when there's so many successful CEOs of companies that listen to you and could answer this question easily as well. But I'll just say at a very high level, the model of the firm is the beginning point. If during a refinance market, it's real easy to get comfortable focusing on refinances. And, you know, it's classic who moved my cheese. If you aren't preparing for that pile of cheese running out, you're going to find yourself unprepared for what happens next. So, you know, companies that did very well, centralized platforms, originating refinances over the last several years during quantitative easing and the HARP refinance program and extremely low interest rates in the marketplace, they had some wonderful years with high margins and high profitability. We've shifted to a purchase market, and we're looking at the business models out there right now. We do, as you know, through our peer group roundtables, we are looking at basis points of profitability and how it's shifting. And the only thing I would say is, you know, margins are squeezing across the board, but the best retail originators, the ones that have the highest percentage of retail and had it, are the ones that are still in growth mode and doing so with continued marginal profits quarter in and quarter out. The ones that are having the biggest challenge, I would say, are the ones that were refinanced centralized platforms and the phone's just not ringing anymore and they still have fixed overhead that's too high. And then, quite frankly, the third-party markets are having some difficulty. Wholesale is very competitive. Margins are being squeezed out. So, you know, these are the kind of markets that really kind of separate the business models that survive. And, you know, as you know, David, better than anybody, and anybody here listening knows, culture starts at the top, and you need to create a culture of success. And good leadership has to know and see market conditions shifting and help get their organizations adjusted to respond to that market shift. And, you know, if it's never too late. It may mean that you have to go some periods of really tight profitability, but you've got to learn to change. And remember, I was talking about situational leadership a moment ago. A great refinance rep is a reactive loan officer. The phones are ringing, they're answering the phone, and they can build up big pipelines of refinances. When it shifts to a purchase market is a proactive market, not a reactive market. You've got to go out and find the loans. You've got to learn to develop relationships with realtors to get into that wholesale, a pull-through sale environment where they will refer their clients to you. It takes longer to get a transaction. You've got to be far more patient and focus on an entirely different set of action steps. And so, you know, one successful loan rep one day can be turned into suddenly an unsuccessful liability if the set of skills that made them successful in a refi market doesn't transition to a purchase market. And that's where leadership and management can come into play. So we're seeing those differences now in business models in the marketplace. And I encourage everybody, as they look at organizations, if they're considering career changes or opportunities, don't just look at volume, because Volume can gloss over profits. And so it's really important to look at the entire culture of the firm, their systems, their capabilities, how they view about gaining access to the home purchase market, because, you know, for the next several years, that's going to be the model that is going to be successful more than any other.
We're talking about shifts. You addressed that there are some shifts. There are some changes coming. And with the change of this administration, we're seeing some Muchen specifically is really putting some pressure. And we're going to talk about this on the Lincoln on Lending podcast. Again, this is the Lincoln on Leadership podcast. But I do want to get your thoughts about where you see the direction. For example, the GSEs. There's even talk about privatizing Ginnie Mae. What are your thoughts on this? I mean, there's opinion, and then there's just, what do you think? Is this good? Where do you see this heading? And how should people be reacting to this or preparing in light of some of these changes?
I think the system's going to continue functioning, and I would encourage everybody not to worry about the possible legislative reform of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, because all the legislators, everybody on the Senate Banking Committee, both Republican and Democrat, are concerned about smooth transition. And the ability to get access to, you know, a TBA market is, I believe, is going to exist long term, regardless of the process. I will tell you that as of this week, David, which is the last week of June, I'm testifying on Thursday in front of the Senate Banking Committee, the first hearing they're holding on GSE reform in the new administration. And there's only three panelists. It's myself, Ed DeMarco, who's the former FHFA acting director, and then a consumer advocate named Matt Calhoun. But they only have the three of us. And so we're the foundational hearing, but it's clearly a sign that they're moving forward. We've seen comments by Senators Warner and Corker in the media just in recent days about their focus on GSE reform. Chairman Crapo is focusing on it. I believe pretty strongly there's going to be GSE reform legislation. And I think this time it'll likely go further than the last time. Now, will it ultimately go to law? I'm not going to give an opportunity for all the Washington skeptics to say nothing gets done. But I will say that, you know, the Democrats and Republicans both believe that what's different about GSE legislation versus others is it's not partisan.
Right.
You know, it's not like the healthcare debate, which is clearly dividing purely along partisan lines with a lot of emotion. So is tax reform. GSE reform is substantive. It's technical. It's complicated. But I've had conversations with Senator Elizabeth Warren. I know everybody's favorite on this phone. And Senator Crapo on the Republican side, and Senator Corker, who's a good friend on the Republican side. And I'll tell you, they all want reform, and they all actually have similar desires, although they differ on things like the depth of affordable housing commitments and things of that sort. But again, for everybody here, focus on your business. You know, no one's going to let this system blow up. It's too important. And even the ideas around Ginnie Mae as a platform or the CSP as a platform, that's plumbing, and it'll all get worked out through the legislative process. I've been working on this too closely, but, you know, I feel fairly confident that no matter what happens here, whatever transition occurs, it's going to take years to happen. It'll be, the focus will be to make it as smooth as possible, and the ability to get a 30-year fixed rate loan through a guarantor, whether they're called Fannie or Freddie or something else long term, will continue to exist almost seamlessly.
I want to go to the topic of leadership. Who are the leaders that have really inspired you throughout your career? Who are they, and what is it that you drew out of them?
Yeah, I mean, the names you won't know because they're just people who are names of the company. The president of my, I won't mention the one name, president of the company I worked for my first 17 years was Jim Judd. And Jim's an interesting guy because he was the president of the bank. He was part of four members of the office of the chairman. But his background was he started off his career relatively similar to ours. He didn't go to graduate schools. He ended up after college as a Xerox sales rep. And he grew up learning professional selling skills. And he became very successful and one of the top salespeople. And he ended up running a big chunk of Xerox's sales organization. And he was recruited by the husband and wife who started the savings and loan I worked at. He was the culture and backbone of that institution. And he's the one who focused on training and sales training and leadership training. He had a unique blend of combining work and fun so that you enjoyed your job while working really hard at it. He believed everybody should be tested, and he would move people around into different roles to make sure they could cross-train. So I I began as a loan rep. At one point in my career, I ran all the savings, the deposit branches for Northern California because he wanted me to learn that side of the banking business. He constantly wanted to keep the energy high in an institution. He thought by moving leadership around, it never got stale for any organization inside. When it came to market share and growing your business profitably, he was religious about margins and expense control, which, by the way, is that's the secret to success, is controlling your pricing margins and having severe discipline around expense control at all costs, and something I grew up with and took with me over the years. And you know, he always said, you never own market share, you rent it. And to that end, we'd always be creating new products and new programs to adjust to the market. Now, granted, under the qualified mortgage rule and the Dodd-Frank legislation, the ability to be really creative on products has mostly gone away in this country. It's much more narrow. But in the day, we were able to create new products and new marketing techniques and expand the business and test new approaches. He was very big on testing, something I've taken with me to this day. If I do organizational restructuring or have an idea, I'll often start it as a pilot and test it. And if it doesn't work, try to tweak it. And if it ultimately works, wonderful. If it doesn't work, collapse it. And, you know, I think we don't have enough dynamic experimentation going on in our industry. And for the worst of them, it's a pretty stodgy, slow-moving, antiquated business. And, you know, obviously won't name companies, but there are institutions that are still doing business the way they did 20 years ago with the same technology, yep, same management structures, and actually has almost a no-change, no-risk discipline. I just don't think those models are healthy for an industry where we have a millennial generation coming up that's, you know, entirely different from the business that we saw historically. But everybody has their mentors in their career. I feel very fortunate that Jim was that. And he built a group of senior leaders that, when I was a young kid, helped me. Jim Wagen, who is in San Antonio now but ended up his career at Wells Fargo. But he helped me in the early parts of my career and was responsible for most of my relocations to take over new markets. But you need that kind of push and drive. And, you know, all the lessons you learn are really important. Mine were that in the end of the day, results matter. It's not about personal preference. It's not about likability. It's execution. And everything you do or test or structure in your organization ultimately has to produce results. And results is the only measure that tells you if you were successful or not. And there are really no excuses otherwise. So, you know, that kind of discipline, I don't know if that works in today's world. It worked. I'm a baby boomer. It worked for me.
It worked then. I think it works now. I think it's going to work even better as we move forward. You talked about millennials. And we are seeing a new influx. There's some mortgage companies. I'm thinking of Bill Cosgrove's company.
Sure.
I'm thinking Bill Emerson and what they're doing and really opening up the door to bring millennials in. And I know the MBA has some powerful resources available to really help those companies that want to bring the millennials in. What is important from your perspective? What are millennials looking for? What's the most effective way to bring them in?
Well, you gave two examples of Bill Cosgrove and Bill Emerson and Chris George, who's on our ladder. I've seen some of their operations, and it's amazing what they do to attract and retain young talent. I will tell you that, you know, it's a paradigm shift, and managing millennials is different than how we were managed and what we responded to. So you can't manage in your own image in the world today. And we talk about it a lot, even at MBA, where we're hiring a lot of young people. Quality of life, quality of the work environment is really important. I think, you know, we're in a world where quote unquote corporate loyalty is at an all time low, and the willingness to be mobile and leave jobs for new opportunities for younger people is far greater than it was for us. And David, I don't know how you were. I mean, as I said, I started my first company and stayed with them for 17 years. I thought that was a brand of honor. That wouldn't happen as frequently today. And so we don't have the expertise at all, but we do have tools that we're trying to learn from. We have we have Impact at MBA, and it's our young professionals organization. And it's both on the commercial multifamily side as well as the residential side. And we're expanding it to our conferences. You'll see it big in Denver at our annual this year. But it's a chance for young professionals to get together in a different environment and over cocktails and et cetera and share and learn in a high energy environment. And we need more of that, because the more young professionals that come to industry events, if they see a bunch of old guys with gray hair, it's not going to look like the dynamic environment that they want to be in. And, you know, we have mortgage banking bound educational programs, which we've brought to colleges and universities, but we also have our member companies using these educational programs as a way to try to recruit young people into the business and give them a chance to do some online training to see if at least the language of lending is something that's interesting to them. But I honestly look at the other firms that are being really creative. I went to Quicken Loans operation in Detroit, and it's magnificent to watch. I'm not commenting on the business model or profitability or anything else, but I do know when it comes to appealing and recruiting young people, these guys are very good at it, and they move their desk areas around, their workstations around over time. You may show up to work one day, and suddenly you're working in a different building on a different floor, and it, you know, it's clear they're making an intentional effort with color and workstation styling and the styling of the building and the environment to keep it attractive and vibrant. So all of this is stuff that, you know, we learn from, and I think, you know, learning is a never-ending effort, and especially with an aging management group in the lending industry, we need to constantly make sure we're trying to learn how to attract, recruit, and retain that generation.
I like something that Bill Emerson said. He says, you know, we're a technology company that just happens to be in the real estate lending space.
Yeah.
And I think we almost start to have to relooking and reframing what we are. There's so many things we could go on and talk about. But recently, David, you got the news none of us ever want to get. And that is you have cancer, and it was late stage cancer. And I want to talk about that. But one of the things I want to frame up your comments in is this. I'm not seeing anybody take on cancer like you did. You talk about many aspects of leadership with the industry, and you've had so many successes. And, you know, I don't think you're at the peak of your thing. I think you're at a peak, but it's done very, very well. Your career's done well, but I think there's more ahead for you, much more. But in what many would say at the peak of your career, you got some of the worst news you could ever have ever gotten.
Yeah.
And the leadership you've shown through that. And why did you choose to come out as you did?
Yeah.
So transparent about it.
It was August 15th last year when, after months of going through tests, biopsies, MRIs, scans, et cetera, I received a call from my, at the time, medical doctor at a hospital in Washington, D.C., telling me that he would prefer to do this in person, but I was driving home from my lake house with my wife, Mary, and we had him on speakerphone. He goes, "You have stage 4 cancer." And I got to tell you, I'm guaranteed listeners of the show, there are people who have cancer or have had it, and almost everybody has a family member or friend who has had it. But until you personally receive that news, you know, you tend to think you're impenetrable, you're Superman until that time happens. And it was rough. I spent some time trying to think about how to deal with it. I'm in a very public position, as you know. I mean, I run this large association. I'm being asked to speak all the time around the country. I do television and radio for our industry and hearings on the Hill and all that kind of thing. And I knew I couldn't keep it quiet. And I had to inform my board, which I had an obligation to. And what finally provoked me to go more vocal is I met a good friend who's a real estate agent with Long & Foster. And she had just finished her initial round of treatments for a similar stage of cancer, different kind of cancer. And she had asked me not to tell anybody, and she had kept it quiet from all her friends. I thought, you know, that's got to be really hard not to tell anybody. I mean, the visible signs of chemotherapy are pretty difficult to hide. You're going to have to go off and hide somewhere. And more importantly, I thought, you know, the mistakes I made in timing and identification of this were ones that I could help others not repeat that mistake. And so I immediately went public, and people would worry about it. Can I tell others? And I, you know, as you know, David, I was very public out there. I announced it at one of our national conferences that I had it, and have since, you know, written about it, talked about it, updated friends on Facebook and other social media about the disease. And honestly, I've had two responses. One is, I've never realized so many of our members of our industry leadership who've had it, and they just don't show the signs. They're either been through it or they have it in remission. And I thought that's amazing, the strength of so many others who've been through this as well. And the second piece was, as relates to our business, was I've had so many men who are members of the industry go and get tested. I've had some who've had tests that came back, and they're thankful that I prodded them to do it, because they've caught certain things earlier than they might otherwise have. So, you know, I went through it. I went through, you know, chemotherapy, which is a horrible process for anybody who's been through it. They know.
Horrific.
That was followed by surgery, and that was a difficult process. And then I just completed 40 days of radiation, going in and getting radiated every day Monday through Friday at the hospital, which, you know, all of this takes a lot out of you and you learn a lot about yourself.
You would never know. You would never know that you have to take a lot of it because you are continued to go strong. We see the messages and I'm blessed to have you as a Facebook friend. So we've tracked this all along and I don't think there's been a day that we haven't said a prayer for you and continue to just answer you. But you have received a great report.
Yeah, so I'll tell you, for anybody who ever has a medical issue, get a second opinion. The hospital that I started with in Washington looked great. They had beautiful, you know, treatment facilities and lots of well-known doctors on their staff. The treatment they would have given me would have been relatively a death sentence. I ended up going and researching
wow.
the best medical teams for what I have, and I found, and I'm not one to do great research. I often wonder what kind of divine providence intervention happened to have me do the kind of research that resulted in this. But I found this team at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, Dr. Ken Pienta, who's the chair of the urology oncology unit at Johns Hopkins. I literally shot him an email in the afternoon, the moment that day I got home from getting that phone call. And within 20 minutes, he was on the phone with me, telling me to get up to the hospital the next morning at 7 a.m. and all over it. And they ended up applying a process which is in a clinical trial right now. Only 500 men in America with what I have been able to go through this. And it's much more thorough and invasive and a lot more treatment than anybody else has ever had in the effort to try to actually kill it, not just survive it for as long as possible. The good news is
right.
I finished the entire process, which included everything I told you, plus some other drugs. And I'm right now, it's undetectable in me. I'm in full remission, you know, and not sure how long that's going to last.
Awesome.
And, but, you know, the news with cancer today and the way I look at things is, you know, cancer is a horrible disease. And the good news is that the medical advances are happening at almost lightning speed right now. And so, the longer I can keep this in remission and then put it off, there'll be new treatments. And, you know, the hope is I get more of a life than I otherwise would have had, you know, either medical advances not been the way they were or had I not found Johns Hopkins. So, and to some people, it freaks you out talking about cancer. Don't worry. I joke about cancer with my coworkers and tell them, you know, if they're looking for office space, I may have one available for them sometime. And I use all sorts of terrible gallows humor, and it makes them cringe. But, you know, you got to have an attitude.
You do, and you've had such an exemplary attitude of leadership through this. And I'm so grateful, David, for you taking a lot of time of your day here to share with us about leadership, your journey through this industry, and a journey through probably one of the most horrific things anyone could go through. My dad survived this. He went through it three times, came back three times. And I'm happy to say he died of old age and not of that same cancer that you had. So,
well, that's my hope, David.
I'm hoping and praying for you to enjoy a long and full life, David. Thank you so much for the leadership you bring to our industry. Thank you for spending the time with me that you did today. Much appreciated.
Absolutely. Good talking to you.
You bet.
Mark, that was a great interview. I really enjoyed listening to David. And every time I talk to him, I get more insights into why he is such a good leader. But again, as you said before we played that interview, you have unique insight. Your son has worked with him, and if you could add more to what our listeners just heard.
When I said earlier that every level of knowledge I get of Dave, I gain more respect, and you know, unless you have somebody that works right for him that you know intimately, and I don't think Dave didn't know that my son was working for him while my son was there. He's no longer there. He now works in a different area. But the things that I saw that Dave did for my son when he was an intern and then when he was a first-level employee were just cool little touch things that really impressed me, and actually I've implemented some of them in, you know, in my company. You know, the very first one was, you know, a hand-signed birthday card that was delivered to his home. It does that for every employee. My son and his wife had a baby, and you know, they got the normal gifts from family members, but the biggest gift basket that came was from the MBA with a little teddy bear that was pink because it was a girl with her name embroidered on a little blankie and all that, and so we've adapted that. And there's a couple other things that he does just in his daily leadership that most listeners or most people that meet him wouldn't get to see. This is kind of like an inside baseball at the NBA, so that was really cool. And then he talked a lot about how he handled his cancer scare and treatment. You know, I will tell you, as a board member, I came into the board about the time he got the diagnosis, and so I was just really impressed with the ferocity to which he attacked that, and how, and his attitude through that whole thing, and how he continued to work through that, where most people would, you know, feel sorry for themselves and be down. I mean, I think he worked as hard, although he may have been working from his home office, he worked just as hard during that period of time. So just an impressive, impressive leader. Great guy to kick off your series with, Dave. So
as you get closer to knowing someone, you really do get some special insights. And mm-hmm. David's just a humble guy, and he's a great leader, very articulate. The amazing part for me is how articulate he is on the issues.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you were at the NBA National Conference last year at the final concert where James Taylor was there.
Yes.
Dave is a huge JT fan, and this is like his lifelong dream to have JT come to the NBA concert, and he was giddy. He was so happy about it. It was really neat to see.
His love for music is rooted in his family, his love for Colorado. And Mark, thanks so much for adding some commentary to this interview. I'm looking so forward to many, many interviews with you of leaders within the industry. And so, Mark, thank you so much for taking time. And listeners, if you have people that you consider as a leader that you would like to have us interview, please email me at david@tms-advisors.com. And I look forward to hearing from you. Mark, thank you so much for being a part of this first interview, a first of many.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
Thank you. Have a great day, listeners, and focus on leadership. What can you do to be a better leader? And tell others about this podcast. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Lickin' on Leadership, a weekly podcast about leaders in the mortgage industry. Tune in next week, and thanks for listening.